Let's read chapter 17, as related once before. We've gone through this in a quick sense, so maybe it'll be familiar. There are some challenging aspects to it, so you know, it's good to refresh our memories. Sister Carrie, could you read verses 1 through 6, and Sister Cheryl, could you read 7 to 12, and then Ruth, could you read 13 to the end?
Okay, Revelation 17, 1 through 6. And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints, and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration.
7 through 12. And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the seven heads and ten horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was, and is not, and yet is. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, he, even he is the eighth and is of the seventh and goeth into perdition. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast.
These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he saith unto me, The waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth.
Okay, very good. So in the past, we visited chapter 17 both as an overview and as a verse-by-verse, rather quick study, because it was part of our side study on the heads and the horns from when we were going through Revelation 13, and we were introduced to the ten-horned beast, the seven-headed ten-horned beast, and the two-horned beast, and the image of the beast. So we did a side study at that time. It took us to Daniel as well as it throughout Revelation. But we had learned that it was in this chapter 17 that we had very definitively been able to define that the heads were successive and the horns could be contemporaneous. So we learned that from this chapter. It confirmed it. And we also, in this chapter, had a clue to the setting that starts the chapter, what time frame, but we also have a time travel back in history section in this chapter, as well as a look to the future. And this chapter has a unique feature I would like to highlight, and I want to say it now, so as we go through, you'll see if you think it's valid. But this chapter has caused some challenges. It's presented some challenges to the brethren over the years, because we have the beast, and it's the ten horned, seven headed beast is identified, and we have the woman, which is, we're told, is a harlot woman. We have the harlot woman separate and in this chapter, and that's rather unique. So I want to say this at the beginning, and like I say, and as we go through it, we'll see if it helps or not. But I'm going to suggest that the reason the woman is shown as separate from the beast, in fact, shown as riding the beast at times, and shown as the woman sitting on the waters, supported by the waters at time. And you know, in verse 15, it tells us that where the harlot sits on the water, those represent people, multitudes, nations, and languages. So she only sits at one place at a time in the chapter. Sit on the waters, or the woman is sitting on the beast, riding the beast. So the clue we think this is telling us is that the harlot woman is a false church system. It's an unchaste church system. The true church is betrothed to Jesus, the bridegroom, and waits for him to return to then be united to the bridegroom. The unchaste church is the nominal church that didn't wait for Jesus to return, but rather sought illicit relationships with the kings of earth, the powerful of earth, whether they're kings, politicians, whatever perspective. The nominal church has united and worked with the earthly governments instead of waiting for their true bridegroom to return. That makes a harlot. That's what the fornication represents, illicit relationship. So we're all familiar with that. That's nothing new to us. We've studied and seen that. Earlier in Revelation, in chapter 12, we had a man-child that was born. The man-child became the counterfeit Michael in that chapter. It was male, and it represented the lines of popes and the ascendancy, the development and ascendancy of the papacy. But it was a male figure. But here it's a female. The papacy is depicted as a female, and so the woman as a religious, unchaste woman, the Roman Catholic religion, when it's not in control of a government, riding the beast, like during the Holy Roman Empire period, she's supported by the people of many different countries as a religion, even though she's not necessarily part of any of their governments. The people support her, and this is true. This is true historically, it's true today, that Roman Catholicism is supported by the people who believe it all around the world, whether or not she has an active role in their government. Currently, the papacy is not riding the beast. That's not to say that the papacy isn't a religious system that is also a civil authority, because the papacy is also a civil authority. Their state is the Vatican City State. And they believe the Pope is a civil authority on earth as well as a spiritual authority. However, papacy is not involved with governing other countries than its own Vatican City. So it's not riding the beast. It's not in control of other government like it was during the Holy Roman Empire. But as a woman, this chapter is showing us, as an unchaste woman, as a religious element, she is recognized and believed by over a billion Roman Catholics around the world today of all these different countries and languages. So we're suggesting that this chapter is giving us another snapshot, another viewpoint of papacy's history of the past and the current history and what will take place in the future as a religious system, and then as well as being part of a grander church state system at times. So anyway, I just leave it there. I just wanted to bring that out because to my mind, that's what made chapter 17 unique. And there must be a reason for it. Whether what I've suggested is the true reason, each has to decide for themselves. But to our mind, it fits well with what we've learned from other scriptures. If we were to look at papacy in the Revelation as being pictured by another woman, if we went back to the seven stages of the churches, there is another despicable woman that depicts papacy. Do you remember her name?
Jezebel.
Thank you, Brother Chris. It's Jezebel, back in the fourth stage of the church. It was she was depicted as persecuting the Lord's true Israelites, if you will, whereas the literal Jezebel persecuted the literal Israelites in the past. But not to get sidetracked into that, but just to demonstrate that in the Revelation, back in that fourth stage of the church, in the third chapter, we did see the papacy is represented by a woman, an unfaithful woman in a sense. And here, though, we have her depicted as the harlot. And okay. Anyone want to say anything more on any of that so far? Okay. So, Brother James, could you read for us in Revelation 17, verses 1 and 2, please?
One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries."
All right. Opening comments, Brother James?
Just noting it's the one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls. So these are the bowls were the plaguing truths. And it's an introduction to what we're about to um, uh, have explained the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters, as was explained, that is reminiscent of Jezebel, and sitting on many waters kind of brings to mind the city of Tyre that was like an island nation. I think they are thought of as inventing the color purple as well, which is, comes later, that the woman was dressed in purple. Kind of interesting. That's all for now. Over.
All right. Okay, thank you. So let's break this down a little bit. So it says that one of these seven messengers came that had the seven bowls or and talked with me, saying unto me. Who's the me? Brother Adi?
The John class.
Okay. The John class. Very good. Brother Chris?
Same.
Okay. And so in Brother James' analysis, that one of the seven angels, which had the seven bowls, it takes us back to chapter 15. And when we discussed it and studied chapter 15, we determined that the seven messages, the seven angels were the seven messages that the seven messengers to the church had previously given throughout the gospel age. The seven angels were the seven messages overall that the seven messengers had given to the seven churches throughout the gospel age, and that within those messages, there were plaguing truths that would be given a golden bowl, a means of delivering the plaguing truth, the seven last plagues, implying there were previous plagues, previous truths that plagued. But now, these are the seven last plagues, which will lead to their destruction. So we're suggesting that one of these seven messages, which had the golden bowl, the means of delivering the plaguing truth, is now communicating to the John class about the judgment of the great harlot. So if I was to ask you which of those messengers' messages would most aptly fit what we're reading about on this judgment of the great harlot, which of the seven messengers' messages would do that for us? Brother Adi.
Brother Russo, he wrote extensively on the Catholic Church and the demise of the church.
Okay, very good. Sister Cheryl?
I was going to say the fifth one, the false idea of the popes and cardinals and bishops and establishing their thoughts is Christ's kingdom. Over.
Okay, so that would be a plague. Very good. That would be a plague. But as Brother Adi brought out, we're looking for the messenger that had that plague. And that Brother Russell seems to fit that bill quite nicely. But we see your perspective if we were focusing on which plague. Brother Chris.
I think Laodicean, even the name means tried or judged people. So that kind of lends itself with the judgment of the great prostitute.
Yes, and it's especially fitting because it's not until the seventh messenger and message was given that we were now in the time of the harvest, the time of the come out of her, my people, rather than earlier when the Lord let the wheat and the tares grow together. So it would be fitting, again, from that perspective. Brother James.
I was just going to mention that the in the sixth stage of the church, Luther did cite papacy as the man of sin. But we know, like, of course, that's a truth. That wasn't, like, that wasn't the truth before him. But the difference with Brother Russell, why this would fit better, is because it's more of a bowl being poured out over the earth, because instead of a trumpet blast, because Luther, like, he barely could publicize his thoughts compared to what Brother Russell did. The amount of writing that Brother Russell did, you wouldn't be able to post on a door, you know, and the millions of copies distributed throughout the world. So, though it's a similar message, it's nothing, the detail isn't there, and the far-reaching aspect of it doesn't compare to Brother Russell. Over.
That's true. And that was a time of a reformation rather than an abandonment of the church, false church. Good. Sister Debbie, I saw your hand.
I was going to say the same thing, that Luther did have an effect on papacy. That was all. Over.
Right. Too bad that his system became one of these harlot daughters. Brother Chris.
Oh, I was going to say, also, you mentioned this clue of the time frame that she sits upon the waters, verse 2. There was no papacy to be judged during the first and second messengers, even though we're warned by the Apostle Paul and the Apostle John about these things, Antichrist, etc. But she didn't exist, so she couldn't have been judged or controlling, sitting anywhere. So she does fit from the third messenger all the way up to, like, the end of the sixth, and then the seventh for sure. That's when the judgment message comes. When once again, she's sitting on the waters instead of the beast. And I'm sure you're going to bring out more detail on that. Over.
Yes, very good. Yes, and that's true. We're going to develop that more as we go along here. Thank you. But true. Sister Debbie.
I'm kind of wondering, since this is one of the messengers who carried the seven plagues, it can't be like Luther and them, you know, the messengers to the church, because they're not here to pour the plagues out. So this has to be something future if the plagues hadn't been poured out yet. So I'm kind of a little wondering, what that messenger actually would be, if not the truth that's in the vial. Over.
Okay, so I understand how this can be seemingly complicated, but let me try to word it very succinctly, and you gotta listen for the nuance. The seven messengers, who were seven humans, did give their message. It's the message of Jesus to the church in their historical time. That's true. But their message, rather than them as an individual, their message is what was the important thing. And inside their message contains very hard, destructive truths that will destroy error when they're poured out, when they're forced upon the system. So we don't think in Revelation 17:1 that one of the seven angels is a human. We think it's the message of Brother Russell, his writings that we have read, that enlightened us and showed us who the harlot was, who the daughter harlots were, And what will be her final destruction? And the plaguing truth that are in his writings is what is inside that golden bowl, which will be provided in the future by God as a means of delivering that plaguing truth found in his message. But as we know, okay, Sister Debbie, go ahead.
Yeah, I think I got confused because you were asking who the messenger was rather than just asking what the message was. And I think that's what confused me. Over.
Okay, very good. Glad it got sorted. Brother Dan, do you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to say that the message of the seventh messenger, the harvest message, we have in the six volumes, especially as you bring out the second, third, and fourth volumes, that's what reveals to us, he revealed to us, this harlot and also the judgment of the harlot, as well. So we have that very clearly in great detail, in the six volumes, especially those three. Over.
All right. Very good. Indeed. We almost take for granted, because we're used to something, we almost take for granted how much work Brother Russell put into the research, the historical research on the history of papacy and Protestantism and the world history that he wrote in those volumes for us, saving us from having to sort through numerous voluminous books to find the kernel points necessary to enlighten ourselves as to the true history of papacy and Protestantism. He's done that for us. And so it's a fabulous work in that way. Ruth.
Could we say that there's a difference between, it says, there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials, that there's a big difference between having them and then pouring them out? It's not like they've been poured yet. It's just that he has it.
That's seemingly legit, except all I can say is that this was identified for us in the previous 15th chapter. So it's kind of like already something the John class was familiar with, that these bowls would be given. But anyone else on that? Now, there's another feature that helps us in our timing. Brother Chris noted that we're told that the woman, the harlot woman, which we know is papacy, sits on many waters. And verse 15 tells us the waters are all these peoples and different nations and languages. So it's not one country she's sitting on. She's not sitting in a form of a government except her own little Vatican government. But what we see is that she's not on a beast. So we look to verse 11. Look to verse 10. Verse 10. And there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. So these seven kings are the same as the seven heads. And five of the heads are already past. They've fallen. They're already in the past. One is currently at the time that the John class is being shown by Brother Russell's writings, the judgment of the great harlot. So that's the sixth head. And then there will be a seventh that will come yet in the future. And again, this is a verse that helps demonstrate that the seven heads are sequential. You have one at a time. And there might be even a little gap between some of the heads. However, that being said, we did in our study on the heads and the horns, we did offer the seven heads. Actually, we believe eight, but and so if you were looking at that and you were at least relatively in harmony, what would be our sixth head? Brother Mark.
I have my note says Victor Emmanuel around the late 1800s, early 1900s. Over.
Oh, okay. Very good. And if you had that, the suggested seven heads paper, I had Victor Emmanuel the first. Actually, that was a typo. It's Victor Emmanuel the second. Sorry on that. Now, what was Victor Emmanuel? Did anyone have his time more precisely on the period in which he reigned? Victor Emmanuel the second?
Brother Rick, I had.
Yes.
From our previous study, 1870 to 1930.
I think that's showing ahead. You are correct. That's what we kind of like in our sixth head, the Victor Emmanuel the second dynasty, including his follow up. And that's true. But Victor Emmanuel the second had a little more himself personally had a more constrained or confined reign. Did someone have their hand up while I was looking down? Sister Cheryl.
Well, you have it in your notes as 1861 AD to 1878.
Okay. Very Over. Good. Yeah, thank you. Very good. Wasn't sure if I put it there. I thought it was interesting in there that as Brother Mark highlighted, and it's the point we like to highlight as well, is that 1870 saw a dramatic change in Italy. Now, Victor Emmanuel the second ruled over Italy. And what happened in 1870? Sister Molly?
He united Italy by uniting the Papal States to form what we know, I believe, what we know now is Italy. So those Papal States were given to the Pope, was it Charlemagne in 800?
I think that's legitimate. Mm-hmm.
Over.
Yeah, his father Pepin and Charlemagne, the son, together, yes, they granted these Papal States properties to the papacy, I believe. And but in 1870, they lost that. And so Victor Emmanuel II is known as the great unifier of modern day Italy. And, okay. So in saying that, we're in this sixth head period. The woman is sitting on the water. She's not on the beast. She's not in control of a broader government outside of her own. So it fits well with this sixth head, which is not a church and state government. So the papacy wouldn't be involved in the government. But then it fits well with Brother Russell's timing, because that's when he began his ministry and started his writings during the sixth head. His writings were completed even after Victor Emmanuel, but still in this sixth head period until the seventh would come. And so then I think we could feel comfortable that we have two means of establishing our timing for verse 1 and 2. Now, does that elicit any comments or questions? Okay. So Once again, the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. How would we decipher these symbols? Sister Cheryl. You're muted.
Sorry. As you brought out earlier, the fornication is illicit union between church and state. To be drunk is to be intoxicated, and the wine is usually doctrine. So they became intoxicated with false doctrines. Over.
Okay, very good. Further comments on interpreting these symbols in verses 1 and 2? Sister Molly.
Just thinking of that word intoxicated or drunkenness as that it's almost a poison that's taken in. So it just distorts all of the truth, and that the doctrines of her adultery is because she didn't remain pure to the word of God, but mixed it with worldly ways, man-made doctrines. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. Brother Dan.
Yeah, Brother Rick, and when you think of being intoxicated, it shows that the wine, the alcohol, goes to the head, and it affects and controls your thinking. So we see how papacy controlled the thinking of the masses. They came under her control because they were afraid not to, because the papacy, they thought, had the ability to condemn them for all eternity in a burning hell and so on. And they used the civil government to enforce their false doctrine, this wine that intoxicated the people. Over.
All right. Very good. Very good. Thank you. Ruth.
Something very similar. I was going to say that it affects the reason. There's no reasoning with them. It's just filled with so much superstition down to the very bottom that you can't even have a discussion with someone who's so blinded by it. Over.
Okay. Very true. Very true. Thank you, Brother Adi. You're muted.
So it says that the kings of the earth committed adultery and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated. Is it possible that the kings of the earth were not intoxicated when they committed adultery? Because it doesn't clearly state that they actually knew consciously what they were doing. Just a question.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure to an extent that would be true. They apparently basically wanted to engage in this illicit relationship. So that's a good angle. Thank you. Brother James, Sister Molly.
That was, the inhabitants being intoxicated, as was said, like drunkenness leads to bad decision making, and but there's also a time element involved with intoxication, in that it doesn't last forever, and and when it wears off, it's terrible. So the person suffers greatly once the effects have worn off. Over.
Okay. And you know what they say, just keep drinking. Ruth.
I remember reading in Durant on this, and he made the comment that a lot of the rulers that were in league with papacy would laugh about their claims and things like that, and they really didn't they said they really didn't believe it, but when they died, they made sure that the papacy had a lot of their money. So they were covering themselves.
Yes, that's the key thing. Very good. Thank you. Brother David.
I was going to mention that alcohol is a poison and that alcoholism is a conditioning of the body really to accept that poison to a point where they become addicted to it, and that they actually learn, you could say they have a love-hate relationship with alcohol. So they've developed a relationship with it, and along with that went these blasphemous hypocritical claims of papacy. Over.
Okay, interesting. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
Yeah, I was distracted for a little bit, so I don't know if this was already said, but when I think about verse 2, I think, you know, if you had like a car accident, you had two, the kings and, you know, and the whore kind of getting together, getting the car accident. Then you have gawkers and those who, you know, those inhabiting the earth were gawking. They were fascinated by this, you know, and taken in by it. And it's just kind of interesting how, you know, people can't help but gawk at something totally, you know, unusual. And then they get used to it, like alcoholics get used to being alcoholics, you know, and drinking. But it's kind of interesting. Over.
Okay, thank you. So putting these first couple of verses together, Brother Russell's writings have shown us that the papacy as a religious, unchaste church used false doctrinal teachings that she represented Christ on earth, and that if these kings would cooperate with her and give her material support, she would give them spiritual support in the eyes of the inhabitants of earth. The inhabitants of earth represent nominal Christians under religious restraint, a stable society more or less. And they would all become intoxicated with this wine, this false doctrine that the papacy represents God's kingdom on earth, and presented herself as such during the period of the counterfeit millennium as the Holy Roman Empire. And the kings that united with her, she bestowed the crowns upon them, stating they had the divine right. They had God's blessing to rule over the people of their empire. And the people drank the same. They accepted that. And they became subservient to their kings, thinking that indeed this was all part of God's arrangement for them. A church and state government. A theocracy, if you will. With the Pope being the bestower of the crowns. Starting with Charlemagne in 800 AD, until finally the Pope dies in 1799 in prison. However, this is setting the stage. This is what we have learned. This is how we're able to see through the various deceptions and smoke screens that the current papacy puts forth. We've seen it clearly scripturally, and we've seen it historically. But all the time, even after that counterfeit millennium ended in 1799, the people are still supporting Roman Catholicism as their religion. Over a billion people of earth today still do. But this is the background of these first couple of verses. And as we know, people who are intoxicated, generally speaking, this is just a a broad brushstroke, they're a little belligerent. It gives them a little bit of self-confidence. And that's exactly how the papacy presented itself. And this is how the kings of the earth presented themselves. We are God's kingdom on earth now. We don't have to wait for Christ's return. We can engage in this illicit relationship with the current kings who currently have power on earth instead of waiting for the rightful king. All right, Sister Debbie?
Just an aside real quick is when you mentioned Napoleon, I thought, because I was reading in volume 3 today or yesterday. Anyway, Napoleon, how God chooses the wickedest people to fulfill, you know, to further his plan. Like Hitler furthered the plan to bring the Jews back to Israel and to, you know, the hunters. And Napoleon furthered God's plan to take down to a certain degree Babylon. I just thought that was an interesting side thought. Over.
Okay. Thank you. Sister Cheryl.
Well, I was just thinking about how important, even magnified in our day, the importance of understanding these things with, you know, the daughters and our nominal Christian friends, how they, you know, they're the ones the most involved in politics and voting and upholding these systems. And, you know, the whether you take the stand or vote or not vote, but we don't want to uphold these systems. So, and it just seems like it's the Christians more and more now, you know, they're really offended. It's your duty. It's your Christian duty. And they're looking for Christians to be in office, to make the calls and shots. And we just understand that, through these things that it's just not the proper way. Over.
Thank you. And that's one of the very fundamental aspects that we find in the first volume when Brother Russell wrote The Divine Plan of the Ages. He made a whole study on the kingdoms of this world and the follow-up study of the kingdom of God to demonstrate that, as Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. So we don't want to support these worldly governments. But this is exactly the opposite, that truth is the exact opposite of what the papacy and her daughters, as you bring out, the Protestant churches are presenting today. And so that's why they're involved in politics and involved in government and so on. So, okay. Let's read now verses, 3 through 6. And, Sister Alice, could you do that for us, please? Revelation 17, 3 through 6.
So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And then I saw her, and when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration.
Okay, Sister Alice, first off, let me ask you, what, do you have a different word for that last word, admiration? Let's get that clarified first.
Wonder.
Okay, all right.
I was reading King James.
Yes, exactly. Very good. I think Rotherham's has astonishment. Yeah. Very good. Do you have opening comments for us here, Sister Alice, on these verses?
Well, this is discussing the papacy as the woman. And then the 7 heads and 10 horns. well, the seven heads being the government in control at the passing down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The 10 horns would be the territory that it covers. So each of the heads has a territory that it covers. And then the way she looks, we'll discuss, but her garments and her wealth and her trying to look like God's kingdom now on earth, decking herself up. And then the golden cup being the instead of holding the truth, it's holding abomination. And it's described very well in the Man of Sin chapter of volume 2. And then on her forehead is something that is her claims and what everybody can see. And she's the mother of harlots. So that means the Protestants, papacy and the Protestants over.
All right. Very well. Very nice overview. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
We go. Sorry. The word marvel or the great with, I wondered with great admiration in the King James, when you look it up in Strong's, it could be marvel, wonder, you know, but I can see how if John saw the whore with all her gold and jewels and everything else and, you know, this golden cup and stuff, you know, that he would marvel at it because John came from a, you know, small fishing village. And then you have in the next verse, the angel is almost like rebuking him. Why are you marveling at this? Let me tell you about this. So I could understand why we could use the word admire or marvel at this mother of harlots. Over.
Okay. Fair enough. I prefer astonishment because the last thing he sees is she's drunk with the blood of the saints. So it's a little gory, but okay. Brother Roddy.
From Revelation 12:6, it says the woman fled into the wilderness to a place prepared for her by God where she might be taken care of for 1260 days. And I believe this is the time, same time frame that, that this verse, this passage says that the angel carried me away into the spirit into a wilderness.
Yes. Very good. I think this is the main point of that expression. Thank you. So in Revelation 12 is brought out, that's expressed twice. The wilderness experience of the pure element of the church. And what's our timing there in from Revelation 12? What years would we have that 1260-year period from? Burden?
539 to 1799. And also verse 14 in chapter 12, and to the woman were given two wings of the great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. So it's only those who are separate from Babylon, from this great whore and her false doctrines, that you can see the abominations that are being taught and the great power that she wielded, seemingly, she says, from God, that, you know, she was the vicegerent and so on. But it's the wings of the eagle. It's the truth, from the Old New Testament that, will, allow one in this wilderness condition to see the false teachings and to understand what God's true teachings are, even in that wilderness condition, when you know the most of the truth, much of it was lost, but God always had his faithful, and he always kept them fed with the meat in due season necessary during their time period. Over.
Indeed. Okay, good. Thank you, Sister Cheryl.
Yeah, verse 3, I would have said, it's the 1260-year picture of Elijah starting in 539. But I have a note that verses 3 through 6 would be 800 to 1799, the papal millennium. So I'm wondering if that's a correct note. Over.
Yes, very good. That's a point we want to touch on now. So as already stated, and as you verified, our the John class be carried away by Brother Russell's writings to look back historically on that 1260-year wilderness experience of the truer church, true element of the church, from 539 to 1799 is so true. But I think we refine it within that period because we're seeing the woman sit on a scarlet-colored beast. So she is riding the beast. She's not pictured as sitting on the waters. She is now in a governmental control picture. And we would make that, in our way of thinking, the fourth head of the Roman beast, starting in 800 AD with the Pope crowning Charlemagne and continuing to 1799 when the Pope was imprisoned by Napoleon and died there. He was actually taken prisoner in 1798, but he died 18 months later in 1799. So it's, as said, 800 to 1799 is the counterfeit millennium. We give it the broad term of the Holy Roman Empire. And so that zeroes in to the larger portion of that 1260-year wilderness condition. However, as stated, you need to be in the wilderness condition, either literally outside of the city of mystic Babylon, or at least in your spirit, you have to be outside of it in order to recognize this condition of this harlot woman that's being presented. Sister Bessie.
Yeah, I would like to share my, I see from the golden cup, when I see in this part, I connected this cup when the Jesus Christ opened up the gospel age and give the cup to the true church and says, this cup I will drink with you in my kingdom. So this is a cup which sit the true seat, the Christ, give it to the true church. It was represent his blood. But now is the cup full of fornication and blood of the saints in it, and put it and give it to the people when they get drunk. So two different cup I see, which one bring the blessing in the future and give the church immortality and kingdom, the true kingdom, but here it's a cup full of the blood of saints and the cup which make drunk all people who drinking. I don't know, just comes to my mind the cup, which I see in this part. It's, for me, it's important to recognize the true cup and the cup which the all mankind, those who drink, are drunk. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Interesting thoughts. Thank you, Sister Bessie. And more on that as we develop that a little further along here. We appreciate that. The scarlet-colored beast, having full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Let's take a quick read at Revelation 13:1. Revelation 13:1. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns, ten crowns, and upon his heads, the names of blasphemy, or full of names of blasphemy. And so just here, how do we don't have a woman mentioned, but how do we here interpret this verse and the few verses here in Revelation 13 following? What are we seeing here? Brutus.
Well, we just went through chapter 12 and saw this great battle. And then we see that Michael comes out victorious. And upon winning, we move to chapter 13, and now the John class is seeing this great beast rise out of the sea. Not coming down from heaven. comes out of the sea, and it's got power. It's been given power. It took it away from the dragon. And so this kind of gives us our 539 on dating. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Sister Karen.
I was just going to say that the symbol here is the beast. It's called the beast instead of the harlot. And we know that the dragon is the church, is the state or the government. Over.
Okay, good. Thank you. Berlin.
Yeah, so we have the beast, we don't have the woman, and as we discussed earlier, a woman picturing the church. So here, as brought out in chapter 12, we had the man child who developed into the man of sin. So we have the beast showing papacy having both civil and religious power. And so, it's identified, in that way as the beast rising out of the sea or the irreligious masses. And, so, that papal head, if I understand it correctly, during the fourth consecutive had a ruling power over Rome. Over.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you. So, as brought out, the friends are saying we had the religious element of papacy shown in the chapter 12 as the man-child. And he becomes the counterfeit Michael. And there's a dragon, civil authority. But now in 13, as brought out, we have a change. The dragon, civil authority, gives its power, as it were, to this beast that's developed. And the beast, is, as brought out, it's a church state. It's a religious leader who has civil authority. And that's what the line of popes claim to have and be. And it has seven heads and 10 horns, showing that it is, in this viewing, in 13:1, it is this fourth head period of the Roman Empire's development during the Gospel Age time frame. But saying all that, taking that insight back to Revelation 17:3, our understanding that we're suggesting is the scarlet-colored beast is a church-state government arrangement. So we're keeping the beastly picture the same throughout Revelation. Sometimes it's unique, centered in papacy, with the kings of the earth she fornicated with, like in 13. And other times, like here in 17, the religious element of papacy is shown as a harlot woman who now is riding the beast. She is in control, by and large, of the Roman Empire during this fourth head, if you will. It's just another snapshot. Because when the papacy depicted as a beast is not in control of the Roman Empire, it's shown here as a woman, a religion, supported by the people, the waters. So that's, again, emphasizing the distinction in chapter 17. Just another snapshot. The name's full of blasphemy. What we read in chapter 13 and verse 1, we read that this beast also upon the head had the names of blasphemy. Thoughts on that? Well, we're going to suggest the one that is particular, I think it's being emphasized, is that she claims to be God's kingdom. Papacy continues to be God's kingdom on earth, and that all people should be subjected unto their pope, the line of popes. And this is that presentation, and this is the great deception, but this is this is the name of blasphemy to take the role and the title that's due God and due Jesus. And as we know, they think they're both one and the same. But these are titles of God's kingdom, really. Papacy has no right to take this, so it's blasphemy. Brother James.
I was just going to add that it's, along with the titles, it's their doctrines and their actions that also malign God's character over.
No, that's for sure. Because they do it in the name of God, and it's just horrific. Very good. Sister Cheryl.
Well, I don't know if it's a correct relation, but it reminded me of our fifth volume study, Jesus's titles, Everlasting Father, Wise Counselor. I mean, they seem to want to take that on for themselves. And it's blasphemous because they only belong to Jesus, those attributes. And they seem to take it on. Over.
Okay, very good. So true. Thank you. Brother
Dan. Brother Rick, if you take the title that the papacy takes for themselves, the Vicar of Christ. They're saying, the Pope is Christ's representative on earth, and they, of course, teach the Trinity that Christ is God. So they take that and they say the Pope is God on earth, God's representative on earth. So, you know, just looking at this blasphemous claim to represent God on earth and everyone has to be in harmony with God So if you're out of harmony with the Pope, you're out of harmony with God. Over.
Oh, yeah, right. And we all remember that in the second volume, Brother Russell has a whole page listing these titles that papacy has blasphemously taken to herself. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
I just wanted to real quick thank Brother James and Sister Molly for putting that document in the chat about the Roman history. It's a good, like, refresher. Over.
Okay, great. Very nice. Every joint supplieth. Brother David.
Just a quick comment about Satan's reputation, the great usurper, and the great liar. It just points to him as the originator of this great system. Actually, not a great system, but this papal church, the false church. Over.
Well, great in power, yes, like you're saying, but we know a sinful system. Okay, thank you. And the scarlet-colored beast, it reminds me of Isaiah 1:18. Though your sins be as scarlet. So there's this sense this gross sinful nature of the church-state union of the fourth head period of the whole so-called Holy Roman Empire, of which the woman, the religious element of papacy, had control or gave direction, crowning the kings more or less during those times. Okay, I'm just looking around for hands. Okay. In verse, excuse me. Well, let me say on the seven heads and ten horns, we were going to go through that list. You probably have it from that previous side study we did. We're going to go through that a little further along. But let's just for now, we're going to go to verse 4. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colored, decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. So the harlot woman is, during this time period of the fourth head, she's arrayed in purple and scarlet. Thoughts on that? Well, I put in the notes that we thought it was the Roman perspective of royalty. And I put a couple of verses in there. I think you're familiar enough with them in Matthew's account, chapter 27, the Roman guards who were torturing Jesus before his crucifixion, the ones responsible for scourging him, they were mocking him. And they put a scarlet robe on him, which they subsequently took off before they led him away to carry the cross. But in Mark's account in chapter 15 and John's in chapter 19, they both say it was a purple robe. So without, you know, over the years for our own self, we didn't know if it was a purple robe with a scarlet lining. I don't really personally struggle much with it, but you have seen enough movies and depictions of Rome to recognize that quite often the color you saw with Rome was red, scarlet, was their cloaks. But purple, as we know, was a very expensive dye to obtain. Lydia, the seller of purple dye, is of course associated with royalty. So in either way, and then maybe there's another, the woman, the harlot woman in her heyday she presented herself as properly being royalty. And she was decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. And I want to take the time, we got a few minutes, to read here. And Sister Roseanne, could you read for us in Revelation 21? I'm going to have you start in verse 18 and through 21, but I want us just to, I just want to say that we know in this chapter 21, we're getting a view of the New Jerusalem. It's being described symbolically, but this is a representation of the 144,000, the true church, when they are empowered in glory. And these are the symbols being used in association. So Sister Roseanne, please, 18 to 21.
And the construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The first foundation of jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, I don't know that one, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, and sixth sardis, and the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysophase, the 11th jessup, and the 12th amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was of one pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry for those pronunciations.
Well, you did well. You did well. Do you have any opening comment on these verses for us?
Well, it's kind of like the counterfeit. You know, the harlot bedecks herself in all these jewels. But she's representing the kingdom, and she's not. I was also going to ask, do you think that this has something, in 17, the relationship how she, with those jewels, the high priest wore ephods, and I don't know, this could be way offline, but, do you think that has anything relate, like a counterfeit of the ephod? And just a question.
Yes. Well, there is certainly a relationship to the breastplate with the jewels representing literal Israel.
Breastplate.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was over the ephod. That's certainly true. And there is a relationship then to the 12 apostles, which are the foundation of the city, and these gems representing crystallized character and their colors denoting specific characteristics that were particularly appreciated by the Heavenly Father. But I think your opening comment was really right on, is that the papacy was presenting itself as if it was the true church reigning before the Lord had even returned to take her as his bride.
Yeah.
Very good.
The breastplate probably was a different picture. Thank you.
Related. Thank you. Brother James?
Thank you, Brother Rick. I had a quick comment. It was similar to Sister Roseanne. I was thinking of the colors, blue and scarlet, and the golden cup, and these things that hearken to Babylon when they stole the items from the tabernacle. And it kind of made me think of all the tabernacle fixings, for lack of a better word, and that similarly, it's like a counterfeit almost of just usurping God's relationship with Israel, replacing, you know, papacy stepping in and just taking over all of those pictures and claiming them for herself from the beginning of God's relationship with Israel through the end with the true church and the pictures we see in chapter 21 of Revelation. Over. Did you have a comment?
Okay.
I did. Mine would be after Brother Chris.
Okay.
We're running out of time, so you better go ahead and give it. We'll let Chris have the last comment.
Oh, I was just going to say stones often represent a testimony. Testimony was often given in stones, and so with this woman claiming these things, or being adorned with these, having these precious stones, it, to me, sounds like their claim of apostolic succession. Over.
Okay, that's certainly true. They do that. Thank you. Buckris.
Yeah, super quick. Of all the colors we see associated with papacy, blue is never one of them, representing faithfulness. So, and the other thing is, 21, the true church, pure gold. And here in 17, she's decked and Strong's, and the marginal reading in the King James brings out gilded. So it's just an outer facade. It's not really gold. It's just got a little plating over it.
Okay, very nice. Thank you. So in closing, brethren, the papacy during her heyday took these claims of being the true church reigning before the time was due by presenting herself like that New Jerusalem. And the friends have made their excellent comments. And yet, amazingly, to top it all off, quite literally, the papacy did do this and did present herself as if she was the kingdom of heaven on earth in her day, where she has, you know, the Vatican splendor of art and statuary and gold and jewels. And we see the costumes that their cardinals and bishops and the popes all wear. And it's so ornate. It's all meant to be overpowering to the common people. So actually, this is one of the rare verses where there was a literal and a symbolic interpretation that were both fitting.